That's the real king of this castle right there, one of the gold cloaks had told her. Older than sin and twice as mean. One time, the king was feasting the queen's father, and that black bastard hopped up on the table and snatched a roast quail right out of Lord Tywin's fingers. Robert laughed so hard he liked to burst. You stay away from that one, child. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it was best to rename and rebrand ourselves as the game did so with the second edition. Now we are the White Book Podcast, and each week we bring you your dose of strategy, insight, and all-around geeky goodness. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, but more importantly to you, our listeners. Please consider supporting us on Patreon so that we can continue to make this show the best it can, and I promise we have big plans for the future. This is The White Book. Welcome to episode 284 of The White Book.
Roast quail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something about quail. I've never had quail, so.
Me either.
Yeah. You know, me either. Somehow I figure it's going to be a little greasy, kind of like duck, but I don't know.
I don't
know.
Sounds about right.
I've never had duck either.
You know, it was not all it was cracked up to be.
Welcome to your poultry podcast. I'm Tommy.
Yeah. I'm Will. And Roy refuses to participate in a poultry podcast.
Right.
Yes.
But I mean, I think that's pretty fitting for Game of Thrones, turning this into a food show, right? It's obviously one of Martin's favorite things.
Does he talk in more detail about the food or the sex? Or the vomit?
Well, I think the food.
Yeah, there's not as much sex in the novels as everyone makes it out to be.
That's true. Definitely less than the show.
When it's there, though, it's gratuitous.
Oh, boy, is it. But thinking about the books, there's a particular reason that I chose this quote. And I wanted to share for a moment something book-related that I was reading online. So, spoiler alert to anyone that isn't aware of, well, everything at this point. I'll just say that isn't aware of R plus L equals J. Right? So...
I don't understand algebra, Will, so.
Okay. Well, then, you know what? You and the rest of the listeners will just skip about 5 minutes forward in the podcast, and it'll be fine. So that quote there, talking about that black bastard and so on, is the cat nicknamed Balerion, or named Balerion, rather, that's running around King's Landing that Arya is trying to catch and is the only one she can't and all that, and is rumored to have been Princess, I think it was Rhaenys. Cat before.
He almost certainly was, based on evidence within the text, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah, before the sack of King's Landing and such. And so there was this theory that I saw pop up, because Google's kind enough to pass along Game of Thrones theories posts on Reddit to me, that was just kind of talking about interesting foreshadowing in the novels and stuff. And they were talking about how you could take this passage and some others related to Balerion about being kind of like the common people, or, you know, sort of still see the Targaryens as the real kings, the dragons, because, you know, the cat is named for a dragon. But then it could also be taken another way, because the first guy then to respond to this post, kind of lining out some of the foreshadowing and stuff, and just said, so you could summarize this passage as the sentence, the black bastard is the true king. And I was just like, oh, well, hello, Jon Snow. Like, that's pretty cool. So there's always some neat little thing that I stumble onto even this long after the first novel.
Do either one of you guys know anything about cats?
I know absolutely.
Only a little.
Cats.
How long do they live? Is it even plausible?
14-ish.
14 to 20 years, depending on how well taken care of they are.
Yeah.
So a cat living on the street, unlikely?
I mean, probably.
Rest of this post went on to say that, or to theorize that this cat is one of the creatures around the realm that Bloodraven slash the Three-Eyed Crow has been warging into to keep track of things.
Mm.
So,
well, also, like, so the, it was a kitten-ish when Robert's Rebellion kind of happened. It happened at the tail end of Robert's Rebellion, which in the book timeline is like 14-ish years ago. And so, I mean, 14 years is not, to 15 years is not impossibly old for a cat, so. But I mean, you know, Martin isn't always the best when it comes to dates or ages or that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think this one's close enough that it's definitely conceivable. Running around on the streets, not the best environment for a cat, but yeah, being right there at the 14 or 15-ish mark is probably doable.
And as Ala just pointed out to me, listening to us talk here, we don't know how old cats can be in Westeros, right? We don't know what their age process is.
Fair, there are fucking dragons, so anything can happen.
Cats could live 30 years, so...
Yeah. Suspend your cat age disbelief.
It's true.
Sir Pounce is actually 30 years old, and...
Well, I mean, Sir Pounce is the prince who was promised, right? That's clear.
But I thought the true king was the Black Bastard. Now I'm confused.
No, Sir Pounce, who is the child of the cat Rhaegar, most likely, based on, again, evidence in the text, is the prince that was promised. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, interesting.
Cat theory.
I also figured
cat theories are very important.
You know, there's some other interesting ways I figured you could take that if you wanna start getting pretty crazy with it. About the Black Bastard could potentially refer to the Black Fires, the Targaryen bastards, who not only took that name, but as well reversed the Targaryen banner so that they had a black dragon on a red field, which I thought was interesting because that, of course, was how a very long civil war was started, fighting over whether the black bastard, so to speak, or the trueborn son was actually the heir. So I thought that was interesting, especially with my pet theory that Varys or Young Griff may actually be a Blackfyre rather than.
Did you really just say pet theory?
Oh, wow. That was unintentional.
On fire.
Oh, Mad King, also well done.
Well, got all the puns tonight.
It is highly likely that the Varys / Golden Company plot is tied to the Blackfyres in some way. I'm also willing to buy that Young Griff is descended from the Blackfyre line. Have you seen the theory that Varys himself could be biologically related to, but that Young Griff is possibly the son of Magister Illyrio and a Blackfyre woman?
Oh!
Yes, I've read that one.
I had not seen that particular one. That would make more sense, like why everyone kind of assumes after, what was the last Blackfyre that tried
Nerys
to lead a rebellion?
The Monstrous.
Yes. After his death, people kind of assumed that the line was stamped out, but it was never really clarified that I know of.
Martin says both in the World of Ice and Fire and in the main books that the male line is extinguished.
Ah, there we go.
See? He likes to be cute like that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the male line is, but there still could be ladies running around, you know.
And that still actually leaves the potential for him to pull some linguistic shenanigans and say, hey, I don't think that applies to Varys either anymore.
Ooh.
Sure. All of that's much more plausible than a 14-year-old cat.
Much more. Well,
cats on Earth that have lived to be 14. So.
Right, no cats that stole food from Tywin Lannister.
That's true.
Which is
Tywin doesn't seem very merciful.
Well, you got to catch the cat afterward.
Yeah,
Robert was laughing at it,
it's hard to catch cats, and I can tell you from personal experience.
Yep.
Well, stay listeners, tuned for Mad Cat News.
Yeah, that's been your Game of Thrones conspiracy minute. Join us next week for a bunch of other stuff. Maybe. Well then, should we hit our main topic for the week?
So clever, Will. That's why you're the fearless leader.
Wait a minute. I think I must have legitimately missed a pun here. I still don't actually see.
A main?
Hats, mains.
I was all over it too, Roy. Especially since the last person that we talked about was a Lannister. So
yeah, it all works.
The Lion connection. I mean, Jesus.
It all comes together.
Oh, there you go. Gotcha. I wasn't catching the main thing at first.
So are we?
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, we are foreshadowing. I want to build some hype for the listeners. We are foreshadowing a very important thing to come later in the episode that listeners will definitely want to listen to.
Listen to all of the exciting content in the first half of the episode to get to the less exciting content.
We're going to try it a little bit differently this week. It'll be fun for us, at least. We'll see what happens with the listeners. Okay, so we've got a topic this week. This one was suggested by good Sir Thomas, and it's actually pulling into some theory stuff from Magic the Gathering again. So, Tommy, why don't you give us the super quick bird's eye kind of view of what you want us to hit on this week?
Well, the generality of what we're going to be talking about is an evaluation principle for looking at cards in different environments. This one, as applied to Magic, is generally used for evaluating cards in a limited circumstance, and a couple of the personalities, specifically Marshall Sutcliffe and a few others, have really done a lot in terms of reviewing cards in this fashion and applying it in their evaluations of cards in that situation. And basically, it's called quadrant theory, and basically what you're doing is looking at four different quadrants that you can plot out where a card lies in terms of its value to you and its value within the game. And what we'll do is we'll walk through what those quadrants are, why it's important to review cards in light of those four quadrants, and how they increase or decrease the value of a card when you're building a deck, when you're doing a draft, whatever the case is.
Yeah, and that I think is a good note for listeners, just in case you aren't aware of what a limited format is. That specifically is referring to how you're playing the game, be that a draft tournament or a sealed pool of some variety, not constructing a deck and sitting down to play like you normally do, say for Game of Thrones or the like. Which I thought was interesting because he comments that board state is queen, in his words, in limited. You can't build just a crazy instant win combo deck, and you got to really work on these back and forth trades and combat tricks and stuff, which I thought fits second edition of Game of Thrones very well. But Tommy and I had a little disagreement about that earlier in the chat. What's your thought there?
I think disagreement might be overstating it. All I'm saying is that I feel like, especially with some of the non-board factors that are being built upon and are ever-present in Game of Thrones versus what there is in Magic, there's just a little bit of a different angle to view things. I mean, your plot deck allows you to pretty much on command provide yourself with economy and card effects, right? That's not something that exists in Magic outside of instant speed, zero cost effects, which there are very few of, right? Every turn, you're guaranteed to be able to provide yourself X amount of currency for that turn, right? That's not something that you can guarantee yourself in a game like Magic. And in addition, the built-in framework action of a turn that can target the hand and destroy your options is, again, something that you have to actually have cards on board or being played out of your own hand to target your opponent's hand. So it just makes the value of things not on board a little higher than it is in a game like Magic. That's all I had to really comment there.
Right, and I think the other thing that's really important to sort of expand on what Tommy's saying is what separates Thrones from Magic, I think, 75% of the time, and other games like Hearthstone that sort of have at least somewhat progressive turn structures, is beyond the first plot, there's not necessarily any progress. Like, you can reach what in Magic would be the middle of a game board state by the end of the first plot, if both players open trade with the Pentoshi, where you have full boards and the board could be stalled and all kinds of crazy stuff, right? So the plot mechanic prevents the sort of, you know, clear progression that you see in games like Magic and games like Hearthstone and other card games, like, you know, even Gwent and things like that. The other thing is that Thrones, unlike Magic and Hearthstone and other card games, is mostly a zero-sum game, and that's built into the claim system, right? If I win a military challenge, you're down one character. If I win a power challenge, unless you had no power in your house card or faction card, you are down one power. You know, there's very little positive gameplay in Thrones, where I'm building up my board, and taking nothing away from my opponent, unlike Magic, which, besides targeting your opponent's deck or life, there's a lot of sort of one-sided positive ways you can build the board that don't necessarily mean taking anything away from your opponent. In Thrones, that's much less common.
Well, so, except for dominance, which is inherently built into the structure of the game, where right. You're gaining and your opponent is not. You're not taking from your opponent.
That's true. That is true. Dominance is the only real thing there, which I think dominance exists
and
largely
unopposed as well, I would argue.
Right, but
you have to earn that.
You do have to earn that, and that's get that alongside. Well, yeah, but you get that alongside whatever the additional claim is, unless you have a zero claim plot, which there is one
of right now. Yeah, though it could still happen if your opponent has calm. Sure.
Right. But okay, like 90% of the time in Thrones, it's there's the you're actively working to whittle away at your opponent's board state and things like that, which I think is what makes Thrones interesting and sometimes frustrating again, and makes the quadrants not exactly line up.
I think what that does is, because what you're talking about with the progression, just to illustrate a little more fully for listeners that may not be familiar, is a linear progression of resources, which is very evident in, say, Hearthstone, like you said, where on turn one you get one resource, turn two you get two resources, turn three, and so on up to 10, and that is fixed and set. Nothing in the game, like in the base game rules, that is, alters that. Obviously, card abilities break rules. That's the point of having card abilities, but that's the way the game is set up. Magic ideally does the same thing with mana, though randomized draws affect that, and you could run dry on turns, so to speak. Thrones, as you guys were saying, definitely mucks with that in the plots. But I think another thing worth pointing out is the existence of setup in Game of Thrones, which I think plays into one aspect of these first buckets. I think really what happens in Thrones is this first bucket gets, or quadrant gets shrunk in scope compared to the others. I think we can still apply a lot of the same theories, but the first one I think is just in general less important.
Yeah, and I mean, I think both what you are saying about setup and what Roy was saying about a turn where you accelerate the game state, for lack of a better phrase to apply, where both players were to say start with trading with the Pentoshi, right? And you've really accelerated what's out on the board. Regardless of where the board state is, these quadrants still apply. I mean, it could be a barren board, it could be a overpopulated board, and that within the way that Thrones works, especially with Valor Morghulis in the environment, where it can be an on-command board wipe, you will experience likely all of these scenarios over the course of a single game. And probably should get into describing what those quadrants are. The one thing that, after hearing you talk about setup, I had to make one quick comment that's unrelated to the topic that I've been thinking about more and more lately, is that the thematics of having a setup is something that I feel like I've underappreciated earlier in my playing of Game of Thrones. But the fact that it's not like in a game like Magic or Hearthstone, where it's a duel based experience, right? And you're encountering some other, you know, high powered being that you're trying to represent a duel between them, right? In a game like Thrones, you're representing an existent universe where there are things that are already pieces in play, action that's already happened. I think it kind of it grabs that a little bit and says you're picking up in the middle of a conflict that there's already these pieces in play. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah. If back in, I think it was episode 100 when we had Eric Lang on, I remember him saying that was one of the main things that he wanted to capture when he was first working on the game is, you know, when you open into that first novel, a lot of stuff has gone down, not only in the like semi-recent past with Robert's Rebellion, but also even in the very recent past with John Aaron's death. And you're just kind of dropped into that, and all these pieces and players are already set up, so to speak. So they were actively trying to evoke that feeling, and they nailed it, I think.
Oh, they absolutely did. I think, and this is something I think we'll talk about when we move into the quadrants, I think, though, set up as a mechanic can create problems. Particularly, I think, in second edition, I think setups are probably even more important than they were in first edition. But we'll get there.
Okay. Well, we'll get into those. My only thought before we really get into each of those is just for listeners, they term it as quadrant theory. Please don't just think of this as graph paper where you're marking these out in individual quadrants for a card. Marshall Sutcliffe in his article suggests thinking of them as buckets. I would advocate not thinking of them as buckets either, because if you think of any of those sort of things, you are inevitably going to put a card into only one of them at a time. I would look at this as more of a Venn diagram.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Yeah, much more like that.
So the first one is developing, is his name for that. And alluded to this pretty hard a little while ago, I feel that this one is constricted quite a bit in Game of Thrones, in Magic, where you have that mostly linear progression of resources. He's talking about these are cards that are good in the early game when there are very few things on the table. Everything by sheer dint of resources must be cheap and are relatively low impact individually. In Game of Thrones, I feel that a good chunk of that is taken up with setup itself. But I do think that the earlier turns of the game still apply. My personal example, if I were to pick one, would be the Arbor, in that it's phenomenal when you're developing it on setup. It's still really good on turn one, but the rewards diminish the later you play it, and the upside is much higher very early in the game. So.
Well, I think that's a really important way to look at it in terms of Thrones, right? Is that oftentimes you hear players talking about building a deck, evaluating their cost curve, and something that you'll often hear is that card's great on setup. This is a great card for helping your setup curve. So I look at not only for developing cards that are great for your setup, great for the first couple of turns where you maybe haven't played out all of your deck included economy enhancers, and also on turns that you're bouncing back from a board wipe, be it a Varus or a Valor or something like that, where you're redeveloping in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point about the resets.
Who's next? Who wants to go next?
I'll take it. So the next one is parity, which is describing a board scenario where you're almost at a standstill or stalemate. Both players have equivalent board state, equivalent control, either in one way or another, but they're holding each other at bay. And finding cards that are excellent in that scenario to break that stalemate is something that you'd look at for your bomb cards to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, or shift the, like, put to the sword, right, is a good example of a card that is good at parity.
Two for one swings, things like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think put to the sword has potential if you actually play it at parity, but I do think you have some difficulty in getting to the point where you can play it when you are at parity because that win by five. So I don't know. I would say a little different on that one, maybe.
So to your point, Will, then something that would put you in a great position at parity would be an ambush card, right? Where the board appears to your opponent as being a parity situation, and then boom, you're dropping in a six strength hound and turning the tables on your opponent. Also potentially pulling off that put to the sword.
Yeah, there you go. So I think at parity, cards that are surprises, stuff that comes from hand like that, have a much stronger value.
Or cards in general, like card draw is also really good at parody, right? So like a pleasure barge is good at parody because you're drawing cards and that gives you card advantage, which will allow you to leverage the existing cards you have in the board plus what you just added to your hand to shift the board towards the next quadrant, which is winning.
The very first card that I thought of when trying to evaluate Game of Thrones in parody, Game of Thrones 2.0, I should say, was Widow's Wail. Because it's just that plus two strength enough to either help you win on defense or push through that challenge on offense when you're looking at a board state that is equivalent. And it's a critical challenge that you have to have. So just wanted to throw that one out there before we moved on.
Yeah, agreed. All right, Roy, why don't you carry on with winning?
Right. So winning is the next quadrant. And this one is probably the most obvious. It's cards that help you close the game, that help you push an advantage to the point in which you hit that 15 power, or if you're playing some crazy mill deck, mill that, you know, 61st card off your opponent's deck. So these would be cards like Superior Claim, right, that allow you to close a game, or a card like Fast Eddie, who just will let you bring the game to a conclusion much faster and outpace your opponent and sort of take that window you've created, moving the board state from parity to your advantage to sort of close that window and get that your opponent to concede.
Yeah. And I would argue, I mean, that it applies very easily to power gaining effects, but I don't necessarily think it has to win you the game straight off of power. I think it may just, to me at least, be anything that just kicks your opponent while they're down so hard that they can't get back into it. This is where I think I would lean more towards maybe the put to the sword. Like, if you can win it by five, you're already a little in winning category to me. And then, you know, when you nail their Queen of Thorns or whatever with that put of the sword, you probably didn't win on power, but you may have just put the rest of the game away.
I think that's absolutely the case. I think before we get too deep in the weeds, I think targeted removal in Thrones is good at both quadrants, both parity and winning. Because what it allows you to do at parity is shift the game into the next quadrant of winning, or winning allows you, as you said, to sort of snowball the game. To claim plots like Winds of Winter is another plot, or Rise of the Kraken are good plots to have in the winning.
Yeah, quadrant. Rise of the Kraken I think is my favorite one for that choice, both power and claim.
Your comment earlier about it being much more like a Venn diagram, I think a great card that's an illustration of that is March to the Wall, where you're looking at a scenario where if you're winning, that one character that's getting discarded is going to be much more impactful to your losing opponent than it is to you. But that also doesn't mean that March to the Wall isn't great in other scenarios.
Yeah, I can see that.
The last quadrant's kind of obvious, right, to listeners. It's losing.
Definitely.
Which is, you know, when you're behind, what cards are good to top deck?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of our listeners can already kind of guess that this is where generally a category dominated by board wipes and resets of various forms, right? Something that refreshes that board state back to a blank slate and hopefully lets you get back into things. Is there anything else that you guys can think of that kind of drops in?
Red Vengeance, or Vengeance for Ilya, I'm sorry. Ooh, can't get out of my 1.0 brain.
Yeah, or cancel, like Hand's Judgments or Bran or things like that. Things that can protect you from these sort of, you know, like having a Bran, top decking that Bran on the turn, the put to the sword that saves your board state, you know, that your opponent wants to get the put to the sword off, can save the board state and give you one more turn to try to get another answer card or things like that. So
Those are very valuable at parity as well, because as your opponent looks for that surprise to try and break parity, it allows you to negate it.
Absolutely. Well, the same is also true with card draw, right? Card draw is also good when you're losing, right? Because you know, your hand may suck, but you get that power pressure barge and boom, slap, three more cards, and that could be the Randall that you need to bring you back up to parity with your opponent.
For sure.
So, I mean, again, this goes to the Venn diagram.
Right. Yeah, nothing's in one category. I would even say some forms of recursion or like dead or discard pile manipulation kind of fit in here, like I think I would maybe throw Close Call in. There's definitely been a lot of times where I've been like, well, if I move this character out of my discard or out of my dead pile, maybe I can play another copy, whether I have that one in my hand or not. And then maybe that gets me back into things.
I mean, Close Call is one of those plots, I think, that fits in all three of the quadrants but the first. You know, no one wants to have to open with closing Close Call.
I also think a card like Aria is great when you're losing the core set Aria, because not only does she give you a body that has stealth that prevents her from being passed, so you can for sure prevent that unopposed, but she also gives you two claim soak bodies so that you can give yourself a chance, like Roy was saying with the cancels, to just make it that one more turn to find the answer you're looking for.
I mean, I think Aria, if we were writing an article, I mean, Aria is the perfect card in all four quadrants, right? You like to see Aria on the first. Literally the only situation that Corset Aria is bad is setup, right? But
there you go.
Deer on the first turn. Yeah. You like playing her. She's early. She can give you that claim soak. She can give you that early pressure. If you're on parity, that stealth can help you leverage stealth. And then, you know, you've got, you know, obviously losing. She's good. She's claim soak. I think even on setup, like, you know, I don't like setting Aria, but it's not the end of the world because, you know, you can discard her
curve.
A march, you know, because you know you have two other Arias in your deck. Or if you top deck an Aria, you can put that, you know, second Aria on top of her, and that makes her not only just a safer card, but also gives her that military icon and things like that. So I think Aria is probably, for the Quadrant Theory, one of the best cards in the game.
Well, and I think you stole a little bit of the thunder there, though, that, and I mean, it probably after just discussing what the quadrants are, it's a little obvious that cards that are great when you're losing are cards that you're never sad to see because they're good all the time. If they're going to bail you out when you're losing, they're probably going to be pretty good the majority of the time, outside of
not always
your resets, right?
Yeah, exactly. The resets, a lot of times, you know, how many times have you been in a game where it's dragging out because, you know, parity is held for too long or something,
yep.
And you're looking at your seventh plot that's, you know, a Valor or a Wildfire, and you're like, oh, man.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I think Tommy is more right than he is wrong, because I think one of the hardest skills to learn in Thrones, I know it's one I still haven't 100% mastered, is understanding that the losing quadrant in many ways is the most important in deck building, because you need to think, what happens when I top deck this card and I'm losing the game? It's very easy when you first approach deck building, and I know this was a trap I fell into when I was building decks in first edition, was that you have a game plan, you know what your deck wants, you know the cards that are, you know, win more cards or cards that really push your game plan, and the question, but you don't necessarily aren't good at evaluating those cards that are going to fit really well in the losing quadrant. Like Bodyguard is a great example of this. Bodyguard is a card that's pretty good when you're winning, it's pretty good when you're in parity, it gives you that setup. You know, that little breathing room if something goes wrong. It's pretty good on setup because it's one goal, but it's not a really good card to top deck if you're losing. Like, if you don't have any lords or ladies on the board, that card is a dead draw. It's going to sit in your hand, and it's not going to be very good. And that means, like Bodyguard is not the kind of card you necessarily want in your deck because it's a terrible top deck.
Additionally, with the resets, I mean, Thrones is unique in the sense that outside of Varys, who you don't have to trigger, you never have to use him. Even if you play him out there to just use as a guy, you don't have to trigger him, right? So with the plot cards, unlike in many other games where there's sweepers, board wipes, whatever you want to call it, where you have to say, okay, when I draw this, when I find it, then I'm going to have the opportunity. You always know where it is in your plot deck. You always know when you can play it and when you will have to play it. And it's an art to say, I'm not going to let myself get pinned on Valor, or I'm going to aggressively Valor here, so that scenario that you described doesn't happen. That's a bad player situation more often than not, where you say, I'm going to push this to turn 7 and take the chance that I can close on turn 6, and you end up getting hosed by your own wipe. So I think that outside of your plot resets, any card that's in your draw deck that's good in a losing situation, you're never going to be upset to draw.
Yeah. I think you guys just pointed towards something that is actually a really important, kind of awesome player skill that I think might be more carefully maybe articulated as, and you guys correct me if I'm, you know, off base with what you were talking about here, but is that I think it's a really strong player skill to know the proper moment to utilize a reset at parity, at high like card count parity, to bring the game down to a low card count parity, to move from one parity to the other at the right moment, right? So you're not stuck with that reset at the end turn or whatever. Instead, you play it on turn three when, yeah, you're sacrificing a couple solid characters and your opponent wasn't expecting that, but you're taking out a couple of other ones on their side and you feel confident in rebuilding from there.
Sure, where you've beaten up your opponent's hand and you know that you'll take better advantage of your reset here, even though you don't need to reset to save your game, you can put the nail in a coffin by driving them down to one card and then resetting the board so that they're in a top deck situation when you have a grip full of cards.
If you're going that far, that may even be moving it into winning
sure,
category.
Absolutely.
I don't know. These are
still
fuzzy,
good player skill,
fuzzy circles. As I think we're illustrating, there's not always a hard line even in this Venn diagram when you move from one circle to the other.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, absolutely. I think there's a lot of fuzziness going on. But I kind of want to bring our attention to what I think is, sadly, in many ways, the most important quadrant right now, I think, in second edition. I think Valor's helped a little bit, but it's still there. I think the first quadrant, which is the developing or setup quadrant, is really important. Making sure you have a good setup and also making sure you have a good first turn is incredibly important in second edition Thrones. And a lot of that has to do with the sort of bomb nature of some of the higher cost 6 and 7 cost characters. And the fact if you can get them set up, if you can set up Fast Eddie and play Rob on the second turn, you can clear it. You can tell I've played a lot of Stark recently. You can really just close a game out really quickly compared to a person who may have had a 5-card setup of 3 2 cost characters and an economy card. You know, like second edition, just having bombs in that early first quadrant can often decide the game. Now, Valor's helped a lot with this, don't get me wrong, but it has not, I think, entirely gotten rid of that problem.
Yeah.
I was backing away a little bit from the word problem. That meta, the nature of the meta, I guess, right now.
Yeah, I think I agree. There's the way it is, the way the card pool is, and kind of some of the design tweaks from first edition. There are a lot more cards that leverage pretty hard on that transition from developing or parity straight into winning, as compared to cards that leverage you from losing back into parity or something like that. At least that would be my opinion.
I definitely agree.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And I think the interesting thing about Thrones, and I think parity, and this I think brings around to sort of what Tommy and you were both saying, Will, is that I think parity is in many ways the hardest thing to judge in Thrones because of the nature of things like renown and the fact that there is no straightforward resource curve. It's sort of the hardest thing to maintain. It's the most fragile thing. It's very easy, I think, in Thrones, and I think this is one of the things that's really great about Thrones, is that parity board states are very fragile. A top deck tiers can change a game. A little bit of renown here and there can make a board that seems parity very easily move into the quadrant of winning, where cards like Superior Claim become really important. So unlike Magic, which I think has much more clearly, again, I'm sure the Magic players in our community will yell at me, more obvious when a board state is at parity than in Thrones.
I think I'd agree.
That's really interesting that you bring up determining when it is truly parity. And the card I wanted to bring up in context of that decision point, that understanding, is where do you guys place Scene in Flames and how do you value it?
That one's tough.
I'll go first. I think it's good in every quadrant except losing.
And still playable there.
It's still playable there. Like, I think it's still not always the best top. I mean, obviously, it depends on the board state, right? Like, if you're on your back foot and losing, but you still have Melisandre, yeah, awesome. That's a freaking great top deck, right? Pull that Superior Claim, pull that Put, pull that whatever out of their hand, right? But I think in 3 out of the 4 quadrants, it's almost always good. It's good early because you can get that sense of what your opponent's hand is and know, okay, I can expect a put. Oh, they're not running tier. They're highly unlikely they're running tiers. Oh, they don't have any good characters. Or, oh, my God, they have 4 great characters. I need to watch out for that. Like, and the fact that you get a kneel almost always out of Seen in Flames is another huge deal. The fact is that it's often that 1-2 punch is what makes it such a good card in 3 out of the 4 quadrants.
Yeah.
And so what do you have to say, Will?
I agree 100%. Roy said the same thing I was going to, that it's great in those 3 quadrants. I think maybe in his rush through there, he didn't stop very long on winning, and that it can be one of those back-breaking plays to look at their hand and strip the one thing they had in there that might get them back into the game.
The one otherwise, I'm character, pardon my French.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Otherwise, I'm 100% on board with Roy's description.
Right, and so the one other thing that I'll say about that is during opening or developing or however we want to call it, it's also really good to cripple an economy ramp as a character, as an opponent maybe draws the King's Road that they're looking for to get that bomb card into play or whatever the case is. If it's early enough in the game, just stripping out those economy cards plus the knowledge of your opponent's strategy is huge.
Yeah, that is definitely big. I think the knowledge portion is so huge early.
Yeah.
Well, shall we go ahead and transition into our spoilers?
Spoilers?
Yeah, let's spoilers. Do spoilers, and then let's evaluate them.
Yeah, we'll walk them through the process here. So let's see. You know, I always start a lot of this stuff. How about you guys have the cards called up in front of you? You guys want to take them? Oh, Roy's on it. Roy's got one in mind he wants to read. Lay it on us.
I bet he does.
All right. So I have the I'm going to read the good card, Tommy. I'm sorry.
I knew you would.
This is a 2-cost event. Attack from the Mountains. It's a reaction. Lannister, by the way. These are Lannister spoilers, which I think we always get the Lannister spoilers, right? Well, almost always. I think Banter got it once, but we almost always get the one.
I think frequently we do. Yeah.
Yeah. So
and we're happy about that.
Yep. Non-loyal, 2-cost event, reaction. After you win a challenge in which you control an attacking clansman character, put a clansman character into play from your hand. Do we want to evaluate this now, or do we want Tommy to read the next card first?
Let's get them both out there, because maybe there is context, you know, knowing both cards exist as you evaluate them. Not saying there is, but just in case. So the other card is a non-unique Lannister character, 3-cost military icon, 3 strength, with the clansman trait, the Stone Crows, ambush of 3, bestow of 2, with the reminder text, when this card enters play, move up to 2 gold from your gold pool onto this card, with the reaction, after you win a challenge in which Stone Crows is attacking, discard 1 gold from it to have the losing opponent choose and kill a defending character.
So I guess starting with the event, I'd say it's good in 3 out of the 4 quadrants, which the one it's not as good in is losing. I still think you can make an argument that it's not a horrible top deck, depending on what your hand looks like when you're losing, but it does not clearly have obvious benefits to losing. But it's definitely good early on to create character advantage. It's great at parity, as Tommy said earlier. Ambush is amazing, and of course, this can close a game by, you know, cheating characters into play when you really need them to win the game.
So I think I disagree with you a little bit there on it not being good when you're losing. I look at this as, in a, kind of an analogy to other games, a token creator as well, because say that you are losing, but you're playing this card, right? You obviously have Clansmen in your deck. You're putting it in there because you have that synergy. In a scenario where you are losing the game, you have the then ability to sell out on that one single challenge to then surprise your opponent by throwing additional characters into play to help you defend and buy yourself more time.
I think, though, that case is much more likely when you are at parity and now you add a character to the board to get over parity. Because I think the context of when you play this complicates it in the losing position. because of a couple things. Number one, you have to have Klansmen on the board. Well, three things, really. You have to have a Klansman on the board, number one. Sometimes when you're losing, your characters are being smashed. Number two, you have to win a challenge as attacker. Sometimes when you're losing, you just don't have enough strength to go over the top of their defenders, and they have extra character resources, so to speak, that they can afford to defend more than normal. And three, you have to have a large enough hand that you have a Klansman in your hand waiting to come into play with this. I think there will be times where it is playable in losing, but due to those factors, I think that is by far the weakest of the situations for it.
Okay, so I'm glad that you challenge it. Here's a scenario where I think of, right? So your opponent has been just crushing your hand, right? Say they have 7 cost Cersei from the Lions of the Rock box. They have sure. They have her out there. They have maybe, I don't know, call it Shay or some other intrigue power character. And then the turn previous, they also had some military strength out there as well. And going into this turn, you had one other card in your hand, and we'll say that it was, you know, Timmit or Shaga or some other guy, right? And you Valor to get rid of their military threats and wipe away a dupe from Cersei. The two cards that you top deck are the two cards from our spoiler, right? So they have no military icons left on board. They're not feeling any military threat from you because you have no claim. However, you're able to then ambush in your Stone Crows, potentially say that you are playing Lannister, so you have the potential that there's the right gold on board for you. You're able to ambush them in, potentially bestow one to kill another character because they have no ability to defend, and then also potentially throw in that Timmit or that Shaga. I mean, yes, it's an ifs scenario, but I think it illustrates the full potential of what that card could do. It could create a multi...
If you get a very specific situation where I drew four, where I already had like 2 specific cards in play and drew a couple other very specific cards at this time, sure. But you're like rainbow Christmas landing.
It's an exaggeration of absurdium, of course, but just to illustrate the flexibility of the card, to say in a scenario like this, you could create hypothetically a 4-card swing if you really played it right. Now, the odds of that all coming together perfectly.
I could sit here and...
Yes, anybody could come up dream scenarios.
Dream that up with a lot. Yeah.
All right, okay, I think certainly. We can find a middle ground here, because I think there's some things in the text of Attack from the Mountains that make it a little bit better than other similar cards like Put to the Sword, right, which is another 2-cost swinging event, right, which is that you only have to win the challenge, right? You don't have to win it by 5, you don't have to win it by 10, you don't have to win it with 2. It's just a Klansman wins any challenge of any type, right? Which is, and it doesn't have to have claim. So Tommy's example of this on a Valor turn can be really, really solid, right? Not even just with the Stone Cold, but you maybe were able to save, I don't know, Timmit, right? Because he was duped, right? You win the challenge with Timmit, you pay the 2 gold, because remember, Valor only gives you 2 gold, boom, you get. What's her face? What's the female Klansman in
Chella?
Chella, right? Boom, you drop Chella into play. You've now got 2 characters, or you've got Claim Soak that can protect the Tyrion that you also saved for Valor from your opponent's claim. Like, there's some flexibility because you only need to win any challenge with a Klansman, which in a Klansman theme deck is not that hard.
Right, and that's a
which
much
is why
more attainable
I think it's
example.
Better at parity, pretty much what you're arguing to me. Like, if you just have to win, you just have to have the character on the board, but you don't have to be really extravagant with it. To me, that's saying this is a good parity play. I have a low bar to hit.
I definitely think it's strongest at parity and winning and developing. But I think, to Tommy's point, I think it does have many more – it has a higher – floor, I guess, higher floor here than many other somewhat expensive events that involve around challenges, right? It definitely
sure.
is closer to that good card when you're losing than many other ambush trick events, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I should say that, like, a card that I feel is if I were to map this out, going developing good parity, very good, winning very good, losing, like I still feel that's a very respectable card if that's how I'm breaking it down.
I can't help but lean on it because it's what I've been playing the most of lately is, and I talked about the deck on our last show, is the Jumping Reins deck, right? And in a scenario, playing with Harrenhal, when you're playing from behind, that card is great because it allows you to sell out on a character and say, I don't care if you die. Well, in a scenario where you're losing and making that sell out on a character, you can really make their one challenge count by selling out, putting in your Chella or your Shaga or whomever, winning that one challenge that's unexpected because they don't know what you're going to use your Harrenhal for, right? And then pulling this off to potentially put another free character into play. So you're 2-for-1-ing. It's just another good application for that card, whether you're at parity or you're losing.
Sure.
Right. Unlike the Stone Crows, who I think are terrible in almost every context of all of the quadrants. I think Stone Crows is not a very good card.
His ability is essentially the same as Throwing Axe, right? And how much play is Throwing Axe seen?
Yeah, I think he's a gold sink when you don't need a gold sink. Like, wouldn't you just rather get the Burning Men for one gold less and one military strength less? The bestow
and
is
no ability.
It's the no ability. The bestow here is, I think, the ultimate win more. Like, you know, like in Tommy's situation, yeah. I guess with Harrenhal, you can Harrenhal this in, pay one gold. Because remember, one thing to be clear is that with bestow works any time when a card enters play, right? So it doesn't have to be when you marshal them. It can be when you do ambush tricks. Like, so if you have three gold and you attack from the moon these guys in and you pay that one extra gold and put it on the Stone Crows, you can then do a military challenge and trigger them. But, you know, like that just, again, it feels like the definition of a win more card. If you're bored, it only is really good in winning, and it's clunky.
Well, and he depends on your opponent, like, making a misplay to do it. Like, this isn't a surprise kill effect. They see it on the board, and they know if they defend and lose, they lose a defender. And he only has a military icon, right? So they already know they're losing a character for military if they're going to lose the challenge. So why defend and not win and then lose two characters out of the deal? It just doesn't happen. If he had different icons, if he had a power icon, then I might think about this. But military only? Nah.
Is there a character that does the old 1.0 Marjorie Tyrell ability yet?
One that pulls someone into a challenge?
Forces them to defend?
The lady, the Dornish Paramours.
Right.
Yeah, the Martell one. She only has an intrigue icon, I think. Yeah. It has to be like when she attacks.
Right.
So you're going to have to give the Stone Crows intrigue to pull that off.
And play them both in the same deck, which already...
Which you can do with Mounds of the Moon. Clansmen are one of the few themes that if you were running your Lanny Sun deck with those ladies...
You can maximize the value.
of the Stone Crows. Instead of just writing literally all the other good Clansmen cards, including one we just spoiled.
And hey, since bestow works when they're put in play for anything, if you Arion the Stone Crows into play, you can bestow onto them.
I mean, Arion is definitely a good card with some of the higher cost, 5 or less lower bestow stuff. So, you know, only paying the bestow cost. But that's stuff we can talk about when we get into the cycle, right?
Yeah, sure.
About whether or not bestow is a good mechanic or not.
Stone Crows, then, our verdict is decent at developing just by dint of being a cheapish character, but pretty meh everywhere else.
I mean, losing, I think it's straight up just bad. Like, I think, like, you do not, I mean, besides the fact that, okay, anytime you top deck a character when you're losing, unless that character's already in the dead pile and unique, is.
Yeah, there's some value.
There's some value, but I mean, still, like, if you're behind in the board, this guy is very
solid. Not what you want.
Yeah.
I guess any card with ambush is somewhat valuable too.
Right. The ambush does, anytime you can ambush someone in, it does have some advantages. But at that point, though, wouldn't you rather be top decking the Burn Men? Because the Burn Men
every time.
Two gold. And, you know, because again, the way the bestow works, right? You have to have at least 4 gold if you're ambushing them in naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a card. Just not very a card I'm fond of.
Yeah. Yeah. But, well.
No bueno.
I think that covers Quadrant Theory pretty well for Game of Thrones. Thanks for running through this, guys. This was fun.
It was.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting once we get some more 2.0 draft experiences going to look at
yeah.
it in more detail.
I agree. Props and slops?
Props and slops.
All right. Does anybody have anything this week?
I've been in preparation of Mass Effect 4 coming out next month. I've been playing the Mass Effect games. They still remain good. Haters gonna hate. But
did you replay Mass Effect 1?
I did. I liked
Good man.
I enjoyed the story of Mass Effect 1, which is every time I've replayed it. I did not always like the gameplay. In many ways, it was the wrong thing to play because they're returning a lot of the gameplay from Mass Effect 1 for Mass Effect 4. Like, driving around the Mako is not fun in Mass Effect 1. It may be fun in Mass Effect 4. I'll see in the end of March. But, because I buy every BioWare game the day it comes out. But, yeah, it was not good. But anyway, Mass Effect 2, which is I'm currently like a quarter of the way through, is...
There you go.
Is really good. And I'm excited about 3 because I'm one of the few people who overall enjoyed his Mass Effect 3. So I will prop the Mass Effect experience.
So. Oh, they're so good. I'm right there with you, Roy. I'm just going to piggyback on that and say they're amazing. And that I loved 3 and the ending, and I thought it was great. My ending, the correct ending.
Which was blue or green, to keep it mildly spoiler.
Well, okay, let me preface this slightly and say that I played 100% blue up until...
Oh, yeah, me too. Paragon all the way, man. Guy Shepard.
Not trying to like game the system, just in the situations I was put in, I tried to make the choice that I personally would make. And I was up there, you know. I managed to sort out everything between the Geth and the Quarians and so on and so forth. And then I got to that final decision and I looked at that problem and I said, the only choice Shepard can make is red.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. I did. That's very interesting because I did the thing where I went, I had spent the whole game playing blue. I always play the nice guy. I'm always nice guy Roy, or in the case of Mass Effect, nice guy Shepard. And I'll be nice guy Ryder, right? I think is the protagonist of Mass Effect 4.
Yes. Yeah. The Ryder twins.
Yeah. Well, I think they'll kill off one of them, right? So you pick the man or the woman.
Right. But I was going to say, I think you get to pick which one you play as at the start, right?
Yeah. So, but at the end of the day, I picked green because I was like, oh, I spent all this time. You know, like I encouraged robot on human affection. I saved both the Quarian and the Geth. I was like, oh yeah, I like organics and non-organics getting along. I can't blow them all up. We're just well in this boat yet. Blow them all up or join them. So I was like, all right, let's merge them together. And I was somewhat satisfied with that. It wasn't my dream ending of Shepard and Ashley just making Space Marine babies for the whole rest of human existence, but it was fine.
Yeah, it was acceptable, and yeah. I don't know. I just personally felt that at that point, that the Reapers had proven that they were not to be trusted, and that they would take over. Like if I tried to lead them, that was not valid because I would eventually be subservient to them. So blue was out. Green, I'm being told, is a possibility by an AI generated by the Reapers. So I felt I could not trust what he said. I mean, sure, I figured gameplay-wise that, yes, what he was saying was valid choice on BioWare's part, and they weren't going to dupe me there. But like in world context, I did not feel that Shepard could trust what that AI told him, and that he must choose red to end the war.
Yeah.
Well, and to end the war and save organics anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you get the happy shepherds alive at the end if you have a, what is it, like over 1,500 war score. So.
Yes. Oh, I had mine maxed out because I stripped mine everything.
Yeah, I had mine maxed out as well. So. But anyway, I like Mass Effect 3. I'm excited to get to it, but I got to get through 2 first. So.
Yeah. Sorry, we just went on this long Mass Effect diatribe there. Tommy, do you have anything?
Huh? What? All right, I'm awake. I'm awake. It's going to be 62 in Chicago on Saturday in fucking February, so.
Oh, that's insane.
Yep. Barbecue.
Good plan.
That props for that.
Belated props to everybody that came to the Springfield Store Championship. It was a great time. Beers were had. Busted open a sump along with Kyle. So that was nice. Pretty good. We also finally busted open the Branson Jamboree I'd been sitting on for a while. Oh, yeah. Good times. Good times. Slaps to my own personal performance at this one. I couldn't pull off the trifecta.
You did acceptably, if I remember correctly, from spying on people in, what's that thing called? Jousting Pavilion. There we go.
Oh, yeah. There we go. Yeah, yeah. It was pretty good. I mean, I thought it was fine. You know, I went 2-2, and one of my losses was what would have been a mod loss, went to time, and neither one of us could close it out. So it felt okay. I just thought it would have been hilarious to pull off another third place, but I guess that's what regionals are for.
Yeah.
Any interesting decks or anything show up?
You know, I don't remember seeing anything too zany. I did get paired up first round against a Tyrell Banner of the Watch that I was excited to see, you know, and just see him go all in on all the defense deck. He just never really quite got there. I spent a good bit of time hammering his ability to actually defend those challenges. And yeah, he just didn't get there. That was probably the most interesting single deck that I saw, though. Everything else was pretty straightforward. I mean, Kyle was playing that Lanny Harrenhal deck. RJ that won it was playing Targ, Lords of the Crossing. Which, you know, I knew was kind of a thing, but at least I hadn't watched it in action before. So that was nice to watch. The guy I went to time with was Greyjoy Reigns, so that was interesting to see in action, too. A lot of Reigns at our tournament.
Yeah, I don't have a report from Thrones War, because Thrones War hasn't happened when we're recording this, even though it would have been, I think, a week in the past?
Yeah, yeah. Because so. Thrones War is this Friday after we record this, right?
Yeah.
The 17th, or 18th, rather, I guess, Saturday.
You all starked up?
Well, good luck out there, man.
Yeah. So, I think we fell into the danger zone there.
Oh!
There we go. Good episode.
Yeah.